Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Right, well, thanks for coming along tonight to this location we don't use often, but it's a great location at KPMG. It's great to have Lieutenant General Ken Gillespie here tonight. I'll introduce him briefly. He will be well known to you. You see him often on television and hear him on radio. But as a formal introduction, I should say that General Gillespie commanded the United Nations Sector West Multinational Brigade in East Timor and was the national commander of Australia's contribution to Operation Enduring Freedom in Iraq. He was appointed as Land Commander Australia in January 2004 and promoted to Lieutenant General and appointed Vice Chief of the Defence Force in July 2005. And Lieutenant General Gillespie has been Australia's Chief of Army since July 2008. And he's going to address the Sydney Institute tonight on the topic of command of an army and sustaining capability. General Gillespie, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Sir, thank you for your kind introduction, and I am truly delighted to be here tonight. I think this Institute plays an important role in an open debate on a broad range of national issues, including national security, and I'm very pleased to be invited to participate in the program. On the 27th of August last year, I gave an address at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. It was shortly after my assumption of duties as the Chief, and I used the occasion to lay out my early vision for some reform I wanted to make under the banner of Adaptive Army. And I'd like to use this occasion to look back and report on our progress, as well as have a look forward to see some of the continuing challenges that we face. Army is the largest single component of the Australian Defence Force in the Department of Defence. As Chief of Army, I command over 28,000 regular soldiers, approximately 17,000 reserve soldiers, and around 1,000 civilian personnel. Our equipment fleet comprises thousands of ground vehicles and helicopters and a myriad of other material dispersed widely in locations around Australia and the world. Australian soldiers are deployed in locations as widely dispersed as Afghanistan, the Solomon Islands, East Timor and the Lebanon, to name a few. And while I'm not responsible for the day-to-day oversight of our deployed operations, I would suggest to you that the generation and preparation of land forces to sustain these deployments is every bit as challenging as the operations themselves. Tonight I'd like to talk to you about the important elements of being a contemporary chief of a small yet highly professional and agile army, and what we're doing to ensure that that army continues to provide world-class, well-trained, well-led, well-equipped forces for operations in Australia and overseas. As I've just indicated, I've now completed my first 12 months as the Chief of Army. It's been a year of significant change, not only inside the Army and its sister services, but the wider strategic environment. And tonight I'd like to provide you with some insights as to how the Army has responded to these changes. In May this year, government released a new defence white paper that describes how the Australian Defence Force will be postured over the next two decades. It addresses how we can contribute to operations against violent extremists, as well as prepare for the changes in the distribution of global power that have occurred in the last decade, particularly with the emergence of China and the modernisation of military forces throughout the Asia Pacific. To my mind, the White Paper reinforces the pivotal role of the Australian Army in the nation's defence and in advancing the nation's interests. But I'm also very happy with the results for the other two services, and the various defence groups. This white paper has been produced inside an environment of integrated corporate debate and decision-making at a level I don't think we've seen before in the defence organisation in the preparation of a white paper. The cooperation between the services was and continues to be outstanding, and some capabilities, such as amphibious vessels, air warfare destroyers, and additional C-130J or Caribou replacement aircraft, are as important to Army capability as they are to the Royal Australian Navy or the Royal Australian Air Force. However, it's not only capital projects that will see the Army enhance its capabilities in the coming months and years. In particular, the White Paper endorsed my Adaptive Army Initiative. This reformation of Army, which is being conducted in partnership with government, will improve our training and equipment preparedness for current operations, while also rebalancing our capacity between the regular and reserve components. This reform will see us remove hollowness and put us on a sound foundation for future operations, and I'll talk more about that shortly. First, however, I'd like to discuss one of the key elements that will enable the implementation of the White Paper's initiatives, and that's the Strategic Reform Program, or SRP. The Strategic Reform Program is government's vehicle for deep and sustained reform. The SRP is aligned with the principles of good public sector government that Minister Faulkner has outlined publicly. These are improved accountability, improved defence planning, and enhanced productivity. The SRP is a wide-ranging program that involves reforms to everything from the way that defence recruits, strategises, plans, and delivers, and to how it purchases general goods and services. It has a long-term outlook. To enable this, the first phase of the Strategic Reform Program involves detailed implementation planning. We in defence have always excelled at planning for military operations, and our challenge here is to apply the same care, rigour and discipline to planning and executing a decade-long campaign to reform. That program is, of course, the SRP. Finally, the SRP is a savings program that will generate approximately $20 billion in savings across defence over the next 10 years. Savings which have been earmarked for reinvestment in current and future military capabilities and remediation of what has become known as the broken backbone capabilities such as our IT systems. And the Minister, of course, has spoken publicly about these in his address to the Australian New Zealand School of Government here in Sydney on the 13th of August this year. Ladies and gentlemen, I think that because of Army's adaptive work that we had already undertaken, Army was well postured and very well aligned to commence work on the SRP when it was announced. Part of our Adaptive Army Initiative is a material management stream that is focused on reducing the cost of ownership of the land combat capability. But materiel management isn't the only stream of the SRP, and Army is robustly and productively engaged in every facet of the program. I and my senior Army leadership team are very committed to ensuring that the SRP will produce significant dividends that can be reinvested in high priority capability requirements. In Army materiel management, we've allowed develop over many years a culture whereby unit commanders hoard stores and equipment because they don't trust the system either to replace it in a timely manner when it's required or broken, or provide it at short notice for operations. If you look at this approach across Army, as I do, you can see that this is an exceptionally wasteful way of doing business and one that costs me vastly more in sustainment funding than should be the case. If we can get our commanders to trust the logistics system while also ensuring better responsiveness of the Joint Logistics Command and the Defence Materiel Organisation, we can cut down on inventory and equipment in units with very little cost to our capability, but with major savings to Army's sustainment program. An environment where I must find $2 billion in savings over the decade, this is a pretty important issue for me. But not only must we find savings for the strategic reform program, we must find savings so that we can reinvest in high priority capabilities. Where we find efficiencies, the government will allow us to reinvest these back into these key capabilities. Over the next decade, we'll be introducing a significant range of new capabilities. This process of reinvesting savings will be an important part of ensuring that we're able to raise or maintain those capabilities that allow us to remain relevant for the current battle and agile enough to handle the future battle space. A few examples of the implementation of SRP in Army are worth noting here tonight. Army is reviewing the manner in which material is consumed to ensure it aligns with efforts to drive down the cost of ownership and allow reinvestment, as I've described. The first tranche of this reform has commenced with changes to the way Army holds, provisions, and consumes combat clothing and personal field equipment. This is resulting in a significant cultural change in Army. I say this because, as I've just highlighted, in the past we've practiced inefficient procedures because our commanders have not trusted the logistics system to get them what they need when they need it. But promisingly, this is changing. We're seeing the behaviour of our commanders change on a daily basis. They're no longer holding large stocks of clothing, equipment and repair parts in their units because they are seeing a more responsive logistics system. And we've already realised millions of dollars in savings through better provisioning and stock management policies and through hard-nosed leadership on the rationalisation of materiel. The early indicators are that we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg on this issue, and more importantly, we think we're seeing our workforce understand this issue and we're seeing them get behind us in the reforms that we're setting in place. And that's a really important part for us. Another area for reform is equipment maintenance. We've had the same maintenance processes for technical and non-technical inspections of our equipment for a generation. What we found is that contemporary equipment is more reliable and doesn't need the same high levels of maintenance as our past fleets. So after a pretty sound technical review, we've reduced the requirement, for example, for monthly non-technical inspections on our equipment and changed this to every 2 months. Not much, you might say. But this single and simple adjustment will have no detrimental effect on capability, but it has massive manpower implications and will significantly enhance the productivity of the Army's workforce. We estimate that this simple measure alone will save nearly 100,000 man-hours per year. At the request of Army, technical servicing requirements for the Land Rover fleet have been reviewed recently by the Land Systems Division in the Defence Materiel Organisation. And this has resulted in an extension of the servicing interval from 12 months or 10,000 kilometres to 24 months or 10,000 kilometres. The net effect is an immediate reduction in the maintenance liability and equipment downtime, and a corresponding reduction in maintenance-induced faults, thereby increasing the equipment's availability. The manpower and materiel savings and the potential that we get from that, I'm sure, are clear to all of you. Now, these are just a couple of examples. Soldiers are now more frequently emailing me on my contact the chief email address with ideas for saving money and being more effective, and I'm listening to them. I'm seeing more and more evidence across Army that there is a major shift in how we deploy and use our resources. It's a very positive sign, and one that I and my senior commanders take great pains to encourage. You should be in no doubt that the strategic reform program will result in a more streamlined and effective Army, and I'm staking my reputation on it. I believe that the new approaches we're developing as part of the SRP are rapidly becoming the new business as usual in Army and throughout Defence. In other words, even in these early days, our culture is changing. As I stated a short while ago, we have to ensure that our adaptive Army materiel management stream is fully aligned with the SRP. but this is just one element of a wider program through which I intend to instill in our institution a culture of adaption. Over the past year, our Adaptive Army initiative has made some significant headway in the evolution of our army. And I think it's worth noting here some of the considerable achievements the soldiers of the army have made in this regard. We've restructured ourselves at the army and functional command levels, aligning our command and control with temporal learning loops. This is somewhat of a revolution for us. Traditionally, we've organised along functional lines. That is, all training is done in one command, all land combat forces were in another, etc. Restructuring around short, medium and long-term learning loops is a different approach. It's founded on what we've learned on operations since 1999, and nearly a decade's worth of research into complex adaptive systems by our Defence Science and Technology Organisation. And I believe we're already starting to see the benefits of this approach. We've combined the old land and training commands to create Forces Command here in Sydney. This in turn enabled the implementation of a new unified training continuum. This is a single training model that is aligned with the force generation cycle through the mechanism of training levels and standards. One of the big aims of this new training continuum is to enhance the transparency of the entire training regime within Army. This allows me to reduce the duplication, which had become endemic in the old command structure, and to ensure that the training we give our people is open to constant scrutiny and validation, with the additional benefit that our soldiers will become much more confident in our training and education and therefore have more confidence on the battlefield. Our headquarters of the 1st Division in Brisbane has been re-rolled to focus on the detailed preparation of force elements for operations and contingencies. To assist this key task, a Land Combat Readiness Centre has been established as Army's Centre of Excellence in mission-specific training, mission rehearsal exercises, operational certification, and as well as being masters of what we call the short learning loop. It has an adaptive warfare cell to speed the short learning loop adaption cycle. It now receives and analyses all post-operational reports and other key insights to turn lessons into actions using an innovative new system of operational adaptive notes and directives. We're serious about becoming a learning organisation. Another innovation is the Land Combat Readiness Centre Force Preparation Assistant Teams that are being established to create a single point of contact to coordinate and assist unit commanders who are preparing for operations or contingencies. Like the 1st Division, our Special Operations Command has had its focus on the short learning loop reinforced. And I expect that it too will be supported with operational lessons from the Land Combat Readiness Centre. Our people are, of course, our ace up our sleeve. They're the first priority, and in this regard, we've implemented a range of personnel reforms, including new career pathways, 3-year command team tenures, and the release of a forward-looking Army people plan. We've started enhancing how we communicate with our workforce and the public, particularly with internet social networking mediums such as Facebook, Twitter, and intranet forums and web pages. It's early days yet, but I'm pleased with the progress we've made, and if you haven't visited the Army website recently, I'd recommend that you give yourself a few minutes to do so. Finally, and most importantly, the military and civilian workforce of Army has truly embraced many of the initiatives. This has made my life easier, and indeed the implementation of Adaptive Army has proceeded more smoothly, for the most part, than I ever expected. So I'm satisfied that it's been a good year and that we've achieved much. But I'm not yet satisfied that the Adaptive Army initiative has reached anywhere near its full potential. And across 5 streams of work, there remains much to be done. In the command and control stream, we've commenced the Rebalancing the Army program, which will ensure a balanced and sustainable Army workforce able to sustain those key capabilities that we're going to deliver well into the future. In the personnel stream, we must continue to fine-tune our career pathway strategies for officers and other ranks to ensure there are multiple viable career streams for a workforce that is comprised of tens of thousands of exceptionally talented young Australians with a broad range of skills. At the same time, we need to ensure we increase participation rates of women, Indigenous and non-English speaking background Australians in the Army. In the training and education stream, we strive to continually review the national and international strategic environment to ensure our concepts, doctrine, training and education are relevant and prepare our people appropriately for contemporary and future operations. To this end, I recently publicly released our latest version of what we call adaptive campaigning. This document is Army's future land operating concept and provides the conceptual and philosophical framework and force modernisation guidance to achieve these requirements. Adaptive campaigning, which by the way is accessible on our website, incorporates recent operational lessons and insights and is informed by current DSTO research, worldwide trends and domestic and international developments. Most importantly, it describes the actions of an integrated land force response as part of a whole-of-government approach to the demands of complex war. In turn, this capstone document is informing the redevelopment of Army's counterinsurgency doctrine, which will be released later this year. By far the most challenging aspect of Adaptive Army is the knowledge management stream. It is an integral part of Army's core business and along with our SRP material management stream is the most important element to get right for the future. Now I believe very passionately that the IQ of our Army doesn't reside solely in its senior leadership. It resides in the 40,000 plus regular, reserve and civilian members who comprise our force. And sadly, currently, I can't exploit the full IQ of the organisation and all the great ideas that are out there because we're simply not linked up. Only 20% of Army is able to regularly use the Defence Restricted Network, or DRN. So the vast majority of my soldiers, regular and reserve, have limited capacity to contribute to the way we go about our business and to help improve our processes. This is something we absolutely must address. While we've made some small inroads through the use of internet-based social networking, we need a broader solution that allows all members of the Army, regardless of their location, access to all the functionality that the DRN provides. Things as simple as pay and personal administration. Ladies and gentlemen, just imagine if all of our people were linked through a common network and were able to contribute to the various blogs and forums, share lessons, and have a say in the way that Army operates. I see this as a truly exciting prospect and one that underpins the full realisation of the potential of our Army. Now, Army's not doing this alone. As Minister Faulkner recently noted, reform and investment across Defence's IT systems is central to the White Paper and is a high priority for government. This will involve bringing ICT capital expenditure together as a single portfolio across all areas of defence, replacing ageing equipment, consolidating defence data centres, and improving interoperability with our key allies. So in summary, the challenge for Army here is to fully connect our workforce, ensure that they're well informed, have the capacity to contribute to how we operate and evolve, and are able to widely share lessons. This is an essential part of realising my aspiration for Adaptive Army. And so far this evening, I've discussed how we're going to become more efficient through the SRP, more effective through our Adaptive Army initiative. But while I'm doing this, I also have to achieve a balancing act between the maintenance of an army that is excellent at contemporary operations and an army that is well prepared for a range of future contingencies. In our response to the issues we confront, one of my primary considerations is balance. That is, achieving the right balance of investment in people, equipment and financial resources in current operations versus the potential for future operations. Now, all nations face this balancing act, even those as well endowed with resources as the United States. So how do we balance the imperatives of current operations with investment in the future army? Now, some have argued over the last few years that we've been overly preoccupied with the current operational commitments at the expense of training for higher-end warfighting capabilities that may be required in the future. Indeed, there is currently a vigorous debate in the United States and Britain and other nations around whether land forces should be structured primarily from contemporary counterinsurgency operations or if they should retain a traditional conventional focus. As with many things in life, this is not a black and white argument. Now, for my part, I don't accept the idea that because the most pressing threat is constituted by highly lethal non-state actors, that armies should reconfigure solely as a counterinsurgency force and trade off our conventional warfighting proficiency. While we need to be able to conduct irregular wars amongst the people, I must ensure that the Australian Army is still able to defend Australia and fight conventional enemies, and indeed this is a clear requirement set out in the White Paper. I would add that the inherent challenges and stresses of an Army's high-intensity combined arms training provides the crucible for development of exceptionally competent leaders and highly adaptive soldiers and units. Now, this is not about fighting massed armies in the full gap of Europe. It's about giving soldiers the mental and physical toughness they need, developing cohesion in units, and inculcating a confident teamwork and initiative approach necessary to sustain what we call mission command. That is, we simply tell our soldiers what we want them to do and they're equipped to go and do it without too much further direction. They are the core skills that can be tailored for use in the broadest range of operations. It's through this process of foundation warfighting skills that I can assure government that not only is our Army able to contribute to contemporary operations, but that it's able to provide a range of feasible and effective options for future contingencies. Now, I'll admit that at times this is a difficult balancing act to achieve, and it involves a pragmatic approach and constant adjustment, or should I say adaptability. Underpinning this balancing act, the Adaptive Army Initiative and the SRP, of course, are our people. Now, as I've already indicated, and I'm purposefully repeating myself here, they are our backbone, and they're my enduring number one priority. Regardless of the amount of equipment and technology we purchase in the coming years, we will remain a force that equips the man or woman, and not vice versa. When our people aren't on operations, we need to manage them appropriately. In less than 3 years, the regular army has grown from around 25,000 personnel to 28,000 personnel, an increase of 12%. To support this approach, government provided defence with funding for a variety of retention initiatives. These included short-term retention bonuses, remuneration reform, and improved defence ownership assistance scheme. Attention has also been given to non-financial retention initiatives, including improved geographic stability and improving the work-life balance for our people, whilst reducing the impact of deployments on family life. Now, the combined effect of these initiatives is that Army is now at its best retention result, has its best retention result in over 15 years. Retention has been proved relatively consistent since early 2007, and so the current retention situation is attributable to much more than the global financial crisis. That said, During the period of the global financial crisis, there has been an increase in the number of people inquiring about joining the army. This has seen increased recruiting, but sadly not in some of our critical skills areas. And as much as possible, Army's been compensating for recruiting shortfalls by encouraging personnel to re-enlist or to transfer from the reserve to the regular Army. And we've had some success in this regard. To support this, we're also changing our career pathways to ensure that all our personnel have well-defined development paths regardless of their speciality. These redeveloped career programs now also take into account the increase in our retiring age from 55 to 60, extending the time between our traditional promotion gates. Extending the time between promotions offers us some new opportunities not previously available. For example, women can now take extended breaks from the workforce and have children with no detriment to their careers. This is very important as we seek to increase the participation rate of women in our workforce. Longer times in rank also offer us the capacity to send people on extended educational opportunities or to cater for things like taxing family circumstances whilst remaining in the service, something they previously weren't able to do. Our new flexible career paths are not restricted to passing through traditional gates. Since the beginning of 2009, we've released new Army career pathways for officers and senior NCOs. These comprehensive strategies now provide our people with maximum opportunity to excel and achieve their career aspirations. And I've recently introduced a policy of 3-year command tenures. And this is designed to slow tempo at unit level, reduce posting turbulence, and reduce the incidence of unaccompanied postings. The recruiting and retention of our workforce, regular and reserve soldiers as well as civilians, is one of our biggest challenges. And we must ensure that they receive the best possible training, education, and leadership. Concurrently, we must make certain that their service has meaning and that we provide them with opportunities to contribute to how the business of Army is done, and that we then recognise their contribution. I released an Army People Plan in May of this year, and it complements the implementation of all of the adaptive Army elements I've mentioned here tonight, and it's about right-sizing the workforce and ensuring that it's appropriately trained and educated. Now, we're paying particular attention to increasing the participation rate of women in the Army. We've recently amended our policies to allow a longer period to regain readiness for women returning to work after maternity leave. This is particularly in the area of physical fitness, which was always one of the gripes of our women, that they had to get themselves fit too quickly to be able to compete. We're examining options for job sharing and purchasing additional leave. And finally, we've established an Army Female Leaders Network while also being strong supporters of the Chief Executive Women Talent Development Program. Now, while there's still a long way to go, over the last 12 months we've seen an increase in the number of females in the Army, an increase of about 5%. And we've seen the female separation rate drop from 11.7% to 8.5%. And this is a better rate than we've been able to achieve with the male workforce. And I aim to continue to improve our performance in this area. Now, we are developing initiatives which will result in people wanting to offer longer periods of service. And we're doing this by meeting the extrinsic and intrinsic, or financial and non-financial, expectations of the workforce, and through the effective use of all of the elements of policy that are available to the workforce. A key initiative currently being developed is the Army Work-Life Balance Strategy. And this requires not only policies which will provide mechanisms to guarantee work-life balance, but also sees the removal of barriers, real or perceived, which may impede implementation of these policies. The maintenance of the health, well-being and safety of personnel is an intrinsic part of my responsibilities as Chief of Army. To this end, a number of new initiatives targeting improvements in the management of injured soldiers, including the creation of a Wounded Digger website, and changes to the medical and physical employment standards, which will be rolled out over the next 18 months. A sign of the times is that we've also formed an amputee mentor group to support those soldiers who've suffered the amputation of limbs as a result of their wounds on operations or in accidents. These initiatives are designed to enhance the employability, deployability and well-being and resilience of Army personnel. In the wake of the recent Dunk review on mental health, I've also issued direction on mental health conditions in Army that outline a range of strategies, such as the delivery of mental health and resilience training to leaders at all ranks, more supportive processes for members with mental health conditions and their families, and implementation of unit welfare boards, all of which I'm happy to speak about a little later. Where appropriate, the retention of members who have mental health conditions and the provision of appropriate and effective clinical and welfare support will be provided to enable them to stay in Army as a priority. We're also improving resilience training in our training institutions such as Kapooka and Duntroon to ensure our people are mentally tough and best prepared for the rigours of contemporary operations. One initiative, known as BattleSmart, is a self-management and resilience training session conducted at the recruit and officer cadet level. It is a preventative program designed to enhance an individual's ability to bounce back or cope with increased stress and or adverse or potential traumatic events in their lives. As individuals then progress through Army's training continuum, BattleSmart will increasingly emphasise unit climate and the important role of commanders in identifying mental health issues in those that they command, and the referral process and the commander's role in managing these individuals. The mental and physical health of our people is a command responsibility, and one that I and my senior commanders take very seriously. In the realm of training, education, and personnel management, we're very focused on better preparing our people for operations in a more complex operating environment and ensuring that between operations they receive the best possible education, training and career management. One of the key drivers for seeking to improve our education and training is, of course, the complex operating environment we find ourselves in. Warfare has become complex in a number of ways. The human dimension of operations is complicated by language and cultural differences of the civilian populations we're often tasked to support or protect. But we've also developed a far more holistic view of this environment, an environment which incorporates our coalition partners, Indigenous forces, partners from other government agencies, industry and non-government organisations, as well as global media organisations. Our people must be inculcated with a culture that fosters and encourages an adaptive approach to solving complex problems. They need to be able to think big to successfully deal with what is an increasingly complex and interconnected security environment. We need people who appreciate this complex environment and are comfortable with thinking at different levels to ensure our tactical actions on the ground are even more closely aligned with our strategic objectives at government level. Now, I'm not sure that we've always done a good job in educating our people to give them that understanding or the right skill sets to master the art, but we are trying to improve our education processes along these lines. Finally, our families are an integral part of the Army team. The retention of our soldiers is firmly linked to how well we look after their families. How do we provide rewarding careers for our soldiers while at the same time improving the conditions under which their families provide the support that's so essential for the health of our Army? Now, I've no doubt it's about recruiting the soldier and retaining the family. Our success or failure in responding to the challenges of the future will be determined by our ability to recruit sufficient numbers of quality regular and reserve soldiers and civilians, train them in the requisite skills and trades, and then ensure that we employ them in a manner that gives them a desire to remain serving in the army. This is my overriding priority. So in conclusion, in writing his 1948 book, Crusade in Europe, General Eisenhower wrote that, and I quote, "One of the most important characteristics of the successful officer today is his ability to continue changing his methods, almost even his mental processes, in order to keep abreast of the constant change that modern science, working under the compelling urge of national self-preservation, brings to the battlefield." General Eisenhower's quote of 1948 remains relevant for soldiers today. We need all of the agility of mind to be able to keep abreast of the developments in our profession and ensure that we as an army maintain relevant and responsive capabilities for our government. Now, I will reiterate that I seek to inculcate an adaptive culture in our army. And of course, cultural issues cannot be dealt with by drawing a new organisational chart. It takes determined leadership and advocacy by leaders at all levels. And I'm pretty passionate about this. And whilst the challenges that I've outlined here are significant, I'd like to paraphrase a more recent American general, General Petraeus, by reminding you that hard is not impossible. We can and we will develop the solutions so that we remain relevant into the future. Now, I've covered a lot of ground here this evening, and I think, as you can see, as Chief of Army, I'm required to maintain momentum along a number of different lines of operation and balance immediate demands whilst planning for the future. I hope that you've gained an appreciation of just how dynamic an environment a service chief must operate in, and that you now appreciate that we're grasping the moment and moving forward with great vigour. I think also when you hear me talk about operational tempo, I don't necessarily mean the tempo in Afghanistan or Iraq or East Timor. The program that I've outlined for you here means that people in Australia are working some pretty demanding timelines to get where we want to go. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes my presentation, and I'd be happy to take questions.
We'll get you a glass of water. General Gillespie, many thanks. Have we come to question and discussion? We've got till 7 o'clock. Thanks, Stuart. Thank you. And thanks to KPMG for the use of this facility tonight. If you were, when you were in East Timor, if you still had, if they then had contact the General, what would you have said?
I can remember pretty clearly I had some complaints about the issue of being seen to be an Australian in the UN environment and needing a bit more support from the Australian chain of command for some of the issues that I was facing. I never stepped back from those being an issue, and in the succession of postings that I've had over time, I've made sure that we support our people regardless of which organisation they're working for, in a much more robust way than perhaps I felt I was receiving in that time.
Okay, so there's a question there. Yeah.
Two short questions. What do you mean by maintenance-induced posts? And secondly, how does the reserve fit into the army? How would you deploy them?
Sure. Maintenance-induced faults. What our statistics show to us is that in the 3 months following routine maintenance, we have the greatest level of unserviceability of our fleets. And so if we leave them alone, it's the old adage, you work a piece of equipment hard, it keeps working. If you interfere with it, it stops. And so our statistics actually show that it's not a clutch grab. It's true. So the less we have routine maintenance involved in the process, the longer our fleets will run. The second question was?
How does the reserve fit into the army, and how would you deploy them?
The reserve is an integral part of the army construct these days. We've worked very hard, I think over about a decade period now, to make sure that the reserve wasn't seen to be something that cost us money and provided no capability. And I think that we've demonstrated that change of culture over time with the fact that for the last 3 years, I think it is now, our reserves have mounted all of the operations in the Solomon Islands. That next year I'm hopeful that the reserves will take over from regular troops in the operations in East Timor. And on every operation that we've been on, Iraq or Afghanistan, we've had individual reservists round us out in a number of ways. And then back here in Australia, where we've had some hollowness because we've had a number of people well forward, the reserve has contributed much in full-time duty to make sure that we're able to keep up with the tempo back here at home. So I'm very confident that the reserve has become an integrated organisation in a whole army construct. I think we've got a track record of demonstrating that reserves do actually produce capability, and more importantly, that we've been using it.
This question here in the middle. Yep.
You talked a bit about trying to link up the running 80% of the personnel in blogs and in order to get more feedback and ideas. I think typically people think of the army as very top-down driven sort of structure, and that's quite important to its function in chain of command and that. How do you see that sort of initiative interacting with and, you know, adapting to that kind of top-down.
I think what's important is that the Army's chain of command is responsible for making sure there's clear direction given and that the troops act in the way that we want them to act. But that doesn't give the chain of command right to have all of the debate or stifle debate amongst the workforce. And I think we've moved on from thinking that broad debate, participation by people right across our organisation is a threat to the chain of command. I simply don't see it that way. And I'm very happy to get advice from whatever level in the Army I get it, and I get it pretty freely from quite low levels at times, to sit back and assess whether or not what I've heard is meaningful, whether or not there's an issue that I can take up. And then once I've decided that the advice is worth acting on, I use the chain of command to implement it. And I think that they work quite happily together, those two concepts.
You spoke about areas of skill shortage which are not being filled by natural recruitment. Can you explain a bit more what those skill shortage areas are?
I won't go into them in great detail, but the sorts of skill sets, we don't have enough doctors, but neither does the rest of our community, I guess, at the present time. We're short on some of the specialist nursing skills. We're short on aviation technicians to keep our helicopter fleets going, and there are a number of more specialist capabilities in our artillery spaces and some of our artisan groups that we have trouble keeping people in. So, you know, not enough vehicle mechanics for the size of the fleets that we have. So there are areas where we have some problems. And our problems are shared generally by the Australian society more widely. And so between us and industry and everybody else, we're competing for the same scarce skill sets, and that's our challenge. We've put a lot of effort more recently into going back to people who have gotten out of the services in the last 5 years or so, and we've gone to them sort of saying, well, you've been out for a while, is it as good as you thought it was going to be? Do you miss us? Because many got out for reasons that were not necessarily their own. And to remind them that in the last 5 years, we as an organisation have changed dramatically. So under the banner, we've changed, have you, we're approaching a lot of people and we're getting some pretty good responses back for people who want to come back now. We're focusing on those trade skill sets. We're focusing on where they went out to the mining industry and perhaps what the promise wasn't realised in that industry, and they're coming back to us. So they're not in large numbers, but they're in numbers which give me faith that we can solve some of these critical shortages that we have.
Did many go into the financial sector?
Gentlemen, let's say thank you very much for a very wide-ranging lecture this evening. We really enjoyed it. Could I take you just to the very last topic you mentioned, retaining the family? I'm on the executive of an ex-service organisation, and one of the problems we have is dealing with the defence community organisation who really don't approve of us trying to assist the currently serving personnel and would rather we stayed away. Is there some way we can find some common ground there? Because we offer a vast resource, when they obviously are limited in numbers and necessarily in distribution as well?
Sure, there is common ground. There's a very topical area at the present time where there's a lot of work going on to coordinate the resources that exist more broadly in government and in non-government organisations, the Vietnam veterans community, etc., and our own. I know specifically the issue of which you're talking about, and one of the things that a lot of the ex-veteran, ex-serving members, community organisations don't understand in some ways, and it causes some of this friction, is that our view in our army today is that people who are injured are part of our family and we want to look after them. And there was a view in times gone by that once people became injured, we simply gave them the flick and they were the problem of somebody else, and we don't see it that way anymore. And so whilst that lesson's being learnt, we will have some points of friction, but I don't think any of them will deny any business, because I think that the problem set out there is large enough for us all to participate in a very coordinated way for the good of people who have been injured either physically or mentally in that process. But I do want to make that point here to you tonight. I take very seriously my responsibilities, and I'm not the CEO of a company, as you might find in civilian life. I regard myself as being the grandfather of the Army family. And I have some pretty strong views about what my responsibilities are to people in our organisation who are affected in that way.
There's a question down here.
You mentioned several concepts or terms like adaptability, materiel, modernisation, strategy, etc. But I'm surprised that you didn't mention anything about the scientific and technological progress in warfare. How can Australia financially afford research in advancements in electronic equipment? Not only financially, but have we got the scientific expertise?
Now, okay, related to that
is also education. If university professors quite often find students who can't read and write properly, do you have a lot of soldiers who don't really have enough really basic education?
Okay, right.
Let me do the last one first. I happen to think that I head the paramount workforce in the country. I think our young people are brilliant. I think that they're very well educated. I think that they have a pretty wide community and cultural outlook, and I don't have too many concerns about their education levels at the present time. So, no, that's not one of my principal concerns. On the issue of cost and technology and where it moves, that's always a balancing act for us. But I do think that we have and are developing a better network of defence, science and material organisations, CSIRO support together with industry, because industry has quite a lot of development with our universities. We have contracts with a lot of the universities, and more importantly with our key allies to help share the burden of a lot of these things. And by sharing the burden, we can afford more. And that's one of the efficiency drives, I guess, that we're looking at to make sure that we do stay relevant in a really challenging environment.
Okay, there's a question up there.
Do you have someone with your email? Because it's a chance to back yourself up.
One of my principal helpers is sitting up the back there. But yes, I do. For two reasons. One is the volume, and the other is that if you're trying to get people involved in the debate, then you've got to give them some pretty rapid responses to make sure that they know that they've been heard, that somebody's working the issue, etc. And quite frankly, my work life doesn't allow me to be in the office sitting there waiting to respond in that sort of way. So yes, I do have some mechanisms set up to help me so that people do know that they've been heard. But what I don't do is I don't ask anybody else to send the button response back when we finally decide what the exchange is going to be about. I do that, and I do it personally, so that people... So I know really what the issues are, and people know that they're actually engaging with the chief. That's an important part of the whole game.
Have you decided to follow the Prime Minister to get into Twitter?
I've signed up to Facebook, which was a pretty brave thing to do, because I find that I've got a lot of people wanting to be my friends that I don't I want to be my friends. I haven't yet made the leap to Twitter, but Army has. Army has a Twitter and a Facebook site, and I'm able to see without joining those what's being said.
Admiral Swan, there's a question. Just wait for the microphone.
I recently read a book, Wired for War. I wondered whether you'd care to comment on to what extent you see robots in the future reducing the number of human people in an army in future conflicts. I know robots are very expensive.
I think we're already moving pretty dramatically into that space. Our troops in Afghanistan use unmanned aerial vehicles on a daily basis. We have many robots helping them face the challenges they have with unexploded bombs and those sorts of things in that. So I don't see them as being an impediment in this process, or that we're resisting bringing them in. We think they're a very important tool. And anything that allows us to use an inanimate object to protect our troops is a pretty good development from where I stand. The issue of whether or not they're going to replace a whole lot of troops is another issue altogether, because I think that the mass of our army at the present time is quite small. And if we're going to maintain the range of capabilities that enable us to go from bushfire fighting on one day through tsunami support to war fighting like we're doing in Afghanistan, that the issue of mass is another debate that we haven't really got our minds around yet. So I don't see us replacing people whole scale with them, but I do see them absolutely enhancing the performance of our people, and the more technology moves on, the happier we are with that sort of approach.
There's a question up there.
How difficult would it be in a conflict? You have a common adversary, let's say that they share a common country, and you have a differing groups combating those, or possibly different agendas and cultures. So you might have a coalition of forces with different priorities. Is that a problem?
Yes, it's a problem. But not one that doesn't mean you can't achieve what it is that you're trying to do as an end state. And I think I mentioned in my speech that one of the issues of training our people to operate in complex environments is not only about being in Timor and understanding all the social issues that go with tribal cultures, religious ceremonies, all of those sorts of issues that we have, the hierarchy of societies, etc. They've got to understand that, or else we won't succeed. But we don't do it on our own, and we're always involved in a coalition concept there. And those coalitions themselves can have different religious and ethnic outlooks on those issues. So they require people of some considerable skill to harness all of the differences that come from those and turn them into a single power for achieving what it is that you're trying to do. And that's what I'm trying to paint, is the real challenge for us to train military leaders for the future, is the people who are the conductors of all of those complexities to achieve the single outcome that all of the nations ultimately want.
Just a final question. We've got forces, a small force in Iraq, a larger force in Afghanistan, commitments in the Solomon Islands, and continuing in East Timor. You've got adaptive army underway, but can the army cope with all that? Is all this manageable? Because you've got a pretty busy job.
It was the concept of all of those deployments and the way that we had been sustaining them over the last decade that were the key drivers behind me thinking of the adaptive army construct. We had to change the way that we sustained these operations. We had to make some assumptions that they were going to continue for some period of time. In the past, that was dangerous. If I said, look, I'm going to make an army campaign plan that's going to take me out to 2013, 2014, people would see that there's the Chief of Army predicting how long the war's going to be. And that's not the case at all. But if I don't make an assumption that we could be out there in that period of time, then the adaption that we're after, the sustainment program that we need to make sure that Army is capable of lasting the distance out there if we have to, then that was the driver behind Adaptive Army.
General, many thanks. Take a seat. Once again, thanks to KPMG and thanks to General Gillespie. I guess Ken Gillespie has certainly been one of the key figures in the Australian Defence Force over the past decade in view of the various important engagements where he's led Australian forces, and also because of that in the defence of Australia throughout his career, but particularly in the last 10 years of very busy engagements. And tonight the General's given us a fine overview of the reforms that he and his colleagues are putting in place in the Army and projecting the Army into the coming years, when the Adaptive Army is part of the strategic reform and part of the new white paper and all those very important developments. So it's been great that General Gillespie's been able to come along tonight and give us a report on the last 12 months, a very successful 12 months, and we thank you for that tonight and wish you all the best in the future and wish you well as grandfather of the Australian Army, which is, as a grandfather, it's a pretty important job. And remember, and best wishes to you and your forces. You do a terrific job. And bear in mind, if anyone who missed out on a question tonight, and there were other questions, and we always finish on time, but my advice is contact the General.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.